Dr. Ian D. Kelly to the podium. Ian serves as the Bee Health Issue Manager and Research Fellow for Bayer Crop Science. Dr. Kelly has more than 30 years of experience in the agrochemical industry with Bayer and with legacy companies, holding a wide variety of technical and regulatory positions relating to assessing and managing the risks associated with the use of crop protection products. In his present role, Ian coordinates a range of bee health-related topics. He is the current chair of CropLife America's pollinator team. He's originally a native of Scotland, and he has lived in the United States since 1986. And as of last week, he is a proud new grandfather. So please help me welcome Ian to the podium. And before I turn it over to him, if you have questions that you've thought of for Lori, please do write them down, pass them to the aisle, and I'll ask the staff to bring them up so we can be collecting them and preparing for our Q&A at the end. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, John. Thank you very much to ASTA for the invitation here, and really appreciate Lori's presentation. It's covered a lot of areas that I will not cover today. But I think, you know, one of the things we should be thinking of, and in the broader sense, you know, why are we discussing pollinator health and seed treatment? And I would like to give you a perspective on that. Pollinators are facing a whole range of challenges, and I am not going to talk about the native pollinators. I think Lori can talk much more about these than I can. But I'd really like to talk about honeybee health and the challenges that honeybees are facing. Beekeepers today are overwintering losses. They're losing about 30% of their hives through the winter. Traditionally, they lost about 10 to 15%. And really, when you look at the issue and you talk to some of the beekeepers, it's not that they're losing that every year. Some years, they're down at 10 to 15%. Some years, they're losing 70%. And every spring, beekeepers expect losses. They do build up their hives during the spring. They make more so that we do have a supply of hives from year to year. But if you're losing 30% every year, that is a difficult number for them to make up. And certainly if they have a bad year and they have this 70% loss, they are talking to their colleagues, they're getting hives from other sources because they just can't split and build more hives from the one source from year to year. There are some things out here I'd really like as a way to discuss this is to think about these questions here as whether they be fact or fiction. One thing that we see quite often, and if you go out and Google bees, you will see the statement there, if the bee disappears from the surface of the earth, man would have no more than 4 years left to live. Albert Einstein. The only problem with this statement is Einstein never said it, and there's really no evidence that he did say it. But it's a really powerful psychological statement. You've got an intellectual powerhouse there making a very specific statement. And actually, if you talk to people and said, Einstein didn't say that, they'll say, well, he would have done if he'd thought of it. To me, that's really intellectual dishonesty, and it really polarizes the debate before you start talking about the facts. And I think what Lori described there about the need to get people round the table and talk honestly about the facts. Honeybees are on the verge of extinction in North America. I'll talk a bit about the health of honeybees threaten our nation's food supply. Pesticides, particularly systemic seed treatments or neonicotinoids, are responsible for declining bee health. And declining bee health is a mystery, and we don't know what to do to improve it. I think you will hear all of these things out there, and today I'd just like to talk a little bit about them and give a perspective on them. So I'll talk through the pollinators, seed treatment and pollinators, how we can address pollinator health, and wrap it up. Lori did a really good job of talking about these issues. She talked about there are a range of pollinators, not just bees, out there. There are 20,000 plus species of bees, but the honeybee is really the most versatile. There are 28 subspecies of Apis mellifera, and they will survive from the tip of South America up into the Peace Valley and beyond, maybe even beyond in Canada. So some of these subspecies are really well adapted to their environment. They're not native. They come in almost with the Pilgrim Fathers. I think they come in about 1622 and have been called the white man's fly at times. But really in there to produce sugar substitute at the time and really supplement the diet. If you look at what they contribute to the world economy, I think the UN and FAO have said they contribute about 9.5 to 10% of the economic value of the global food supply. But as Laurie had said, they facilitate one of every three mouthfuls of food and beverage, certainly that we consume in the US. Not all different crops, almonds are totally dependent on bees. Without them, the yield is negligible. Some crops, they get a really nice yield bump with honeybee pollination there, but are not totally responsible, dependent on it. But what their bees are really good at, they're key to the fruits, nuts, vegetables. Many of them benefit greatly from bee pollination. And as we see the world population change, and Dr. Ramaswamy talked about diets changing in developing countries, they need more pollination. They need more bees. We need bees as well. While, again, Dr. Ramaswamy talked about the five main crops out there, the corn, the soybean, the wheat, the potatoes, rice, these don't need insect pollination. They are clearly the basis of our diet, but the things that we like to eat, heavily responsible for bees are heavily responsible for. We hear about the bee disappearing, and certainly if you talk about native bees and habitat changes, we have lost species of bees. But if you look at the honeybee is not disappearing globally. You're seeing a big rise in Asia as diets change there. You would still say, if you look at the number of hives, probably not growing fast enough to supply that changing diet. If you look at Europe had a fairly stable number of hives. Big drop in the late 1980s through to the sort of mid-1990s. And there was a big change in subsidies in Eastern Europe when the wall came down there, which really saw a big overnight drop and then a stabilization. Africa continues to grow, similar to Asia, but not quite as pronounced. And in North America here, we saw about 5 million dropping down to about the mid-1990s. There were a loss and then really stabilized after that. Why? What is dictating the number of colonies out there? Well, we had about 6 million in the US, certainly around about World War II, where people had started to raise honeybees when sugar was in short supply. And then we saw this drop down through until about 1995. We have seen an industry that's changed there. We've seen us going from, hive products and the traditional producing of honey, propolis, other things, through to this pollination service. And what we see, particularly with almonds, we're seeing about 1.6 million of our bee colonies, the 2.6 million that we have in the country, going into almonds every spring from about mid-February through to mid-March to pollinate almonds. So we really do have spring break for bees down there. They are moving down there, and then they're moved back through the country. Some of them go all the way up the East Coast, some up the West Coast. You know, and this, when you do move livestock like that, it presents challenges. The honeybee is a really adaptable species, but there are challenges with that, and that is an area that beekeepers are beginning to work on, because there is the opportunity there for transferring diseases with that kind of movement. And really what the scientists are saying out there, what is being said, and again, Laurie talked about these, but parasites are big. Parasites, especially the varroa mite, tends to come out number one. Nutritional deficiencies, good forage. Beekeepers typically took their bees in summer. North Dakota, I think, gets about 500,000 colonies up there. They've seen a change in their agriculture. They've seen a change in CRP land, and they are not finding it so easy to summer their bees and build their strength up for the following year. So that is a very real problem. Diseases, whether to some extent bees can survive, but you plan the way you manage your bees will change with weather, and sometimes that catches beekeepers out. Beekeeping practices, pesticides, in-hive use of them, misuse outside of the hive, clearly an issue there. And our queen issues, another area beekeepers are seeing, their queens are not surviving as long at the present time. They're having to replace them more often. But I'd like to say just the USDA EPA report on bee health recognized the varroa as the single most detrimental pest of honeybees and is closely associated with overwintering decline. The varroa mite is a mite about the size of your fist or maybe a dinner plate that fits onto the back of a bee and sucks its hemolymph. The real problem with it is, though, it transfers, mainly viral diseases with that. And I think one of the things that has been said here, greater collaboration and information sharing among stakeholders will facilitate adoption of best management practices and is critical to improving honeybee health. And I think one of the really good things coming out of bringing the scientists together is in late February, USDA is bringing together experts on varroa control. They will bring the industry, they will bring academia, they'll bring USDA in there. And if you look at this kind of issue, this is one where we're talking earlier about private-public partnerships. You know, industry has worked in this area. We've looked at ways to kill a bug on a bug, and it's not easy. But I think by working collaboratively here in essentially a small market, maybe we can find a model that will really be beneficial in there. Colony collapse disorder, we've seen it talked about. It's got high profile. It's a nice term. It was the idea that bees disappeared and nobody quite knew where they were going because the queen and some brood was left behind. Beekeepers are not talking about it as much as they used to. And really, it doesn't hit the top five of losses when you ask specific beekeepers out there. Really, varroa mite is up there, but starvation from incomplete diets due to forage resources, very, very high on the list. And if you're obviously added these numbers up now and you realize they don't come to 100%, there are more than one response coming in from what is generally a self-reported study out there. And sometimes self-reported studies aren't the best. Getting good data here is something that we're really looking at more and more. Seed treatment and pollinators, how do they intersect, having talked a bit about the honeybee themselves? And I probably don't need to talk about the evolution of seed treatment here to this audience, but you know, we have moved from the seed-borne protection prior to the 1980s through the systemic fungicide protection, through the systemic insecticides protecting the early plant establishment, nematode protection, and now we're really looking at application technology. How can we improve how these things go onto the seed and minimize the kind of exposure that could affect non-target organisms? And just last week, Crop Life Foundation put out a really nice book on the role of seed treatment in modern US agriculture, which pulls a lot of that data together and a lot of the benefits of it. If we talk specifically about seed treatment, about 150 million acres of the row crops treated annually now. There are really three active ingredients out there despite all the products you see: thiamethoxam, clothianidin, and imidacloprid. Thiamethoxam breaks down to clothianidin, so it's almost 2.5 active ingredients out there. And these are being expedited. They are under expedited review at EPA. EPA typically reviews products every 15 years. They put the neonicotinoids in after about 7 to 8 years of registration. They are reviewing it now. They have looked at the data. They said that they did not see, for at least honeybee health, chronic effects, that there was an imminent harm out there. But they are looking very, very closely at that data at the present time. The benefits that we get from the neonicotinoids, their clearly yield increases is a big one, but they also allow planting independent of weather conditions. They have an effect on plant health and vigor, and really they help plants to get established. The really nice thing about them is they really do reduce environmental load to a large extent. We see fewer sprays because of them, lower application, and really targeted application, and they've got very low mammalian toxicity. So overall, bringing these products in over some of the older chemistry really had a big benefit there. You know, so one of the things we have to do is, you know, look at the honeybee issue or the bee issue in general and make sure that we can manage any concerns around there. And there is a concern, sometimes based on partial or selected information, that neonicotinoids are the major factor in declining bee health. Nobody has ever disputed that they're toxic to bees, but we can handle that to some extent, and I think what we're seeing now is even more targeted work there. Systemicity, I would like to say a few words about, because there is this idea that the material is being taken up into the plant and making the whole plant toxic, and I would like to talk a little bit about that. And again, Laurie talked about the dust hopper issue, and I won't touch on that one so much at the moment. One thing that we do really have to do is look at risk. It's not toxicity, it's not exposure that makes something toxic. Provides a risk. It's putting the two of these together. And that is not something that we always see done appropriately. When we see headlines out there, we have seen the latest issue that this shows why neonicotinoids are affecting bees. It's very much a toxicity study, often done in a lab, often at high rates. So if you look at risk, really the hazard is independent or is an inherent property there. If you fall, that is a hazard. How far you fall, that is the exposure. Putting the two together has the risk, that is your risk potential in there. You have to put these together. And what you do in climbing, you would utilize ropes and protection to make sure if you fell here that you didn't fall very far and you can mitigate risk. And one of the reasons I like this graphic here is I did actually have a discussion on bee health, believe it or not, exactly in that point with the red dot, and I have found that when you start talking about bee health, it becomes all-consuming, and you end up talking to people in the strangest places about them, and I've heard other people with even stranger stories than mine. Pesticide and bee health, what we know, we do know there have been large multifactorial studies done in many of the European countries, and poor bee health hasn't correlated well with agrochemicals, but has with varroa and bee diseases. There's a lot of data out there. The neonicotinoids alone, if we look at the beehives, we see infrequently detected residues of neonicotinoid in there and generally at low level. They are not the biggest component in there. We're not seeing the same sort of elevated losses where varroa is absent. We see in certainly in crops like canola. Canola produces a nectar that's very attractive to bees. They use the pollen as well. And when we're producing our hybrid seed, every seed, canola seed, is treated, and the beekeepers there are not seeing issues of really declining bee health. They've put together management plans that seem to be very effective in these areas. Even France, when they had banned material previously and looked at if there was an improvement in bee health, and they did ban some of the seed treatments in the late 1990s, early 2000s, came back and said they weren't seeing improvements and started to allow uses again prior to the current European ban. And we do have field studies out there, got a lot of information, and consistently we haven't seen the adverse effects in colonies when they're used according to label. And just a word about systemicity here. The whole issue, it's not that you have movement totally throughout the plant. There are two systemic pathways in plant. The xylem moves the water, and neonicotinoids are quite water-soluble. They move up into the leaves, and that is where they protect the plant and the early establishment. You have targeting there. The phloem moves the sugars. They move the sugars into what would be the nectar. And again, neonicotinoids don't move well with that pathway. So when we actually measure the residues in pollen and nectar, we are seeing very low residues in there. So we have got data there. And I think, you know, as a concept, we have to make sure that it's understood that this is just not a total soaking up of the material. So we need the risk assessment to say, here are the residues we've got, here is the toxicity, and put them together. And again, though, Laurie talked very much about the different issue here, about bee mortality. Is there, you know, bee mortality around corn planting, and what can we do about that? That is a different issue. That is the issue where we as an industry work constantly really to bring in technological advances, BMPs, stewardship, education, training. We did it around spray drift, and this is what we're doing now around this potential for dust to move early on in the season when corn is planted and bees could be exposed. Realistically, we haven't seen a huge, you know, if you look at the number of incidents compared to the number of acres planted, it has been quite small. There have really, in the US, been very few alleged incidents, maybe about a dozen last year, less than a dozen this year, although we do have the Canada issue that we're looking at. That is the thing, though, is that we do have to work to minimize exposure because it is an indication of potential exposure, and we're doing that. I think everybody has come together on this one, the registrants and the seed companies, and Jane will talk more about that. The ag equipment manufacturers are looking at designs that can minimize loss of the dust. Beekeepers and the grower groups are coming together and communicating more, and academia has entered in to provide data around the Corn Dust Research Consortium that Laurie talked about. Bee health is going to improve if three things come together. We have science-based risk management practices and put them in place. We have good stewardship, and we invest in bee health as well. We test our products heavily at the present time. They are registered under a high standard of no unreasonable adverse effect. Things change, testing improves. Industry has been in the middle of this, and we are continuing to look at new larval testing, expanding field testing, and really we have been at the forefront of developing these. So we are continuing to work in this area. Some of the literature out here that gets a lot of press doesn't look holistically at the data that there. And really, when we take individual studies, we have to think of them in the whole conglomeration of information. Do they relate to labeled field rates, realistic exposure, and practical field use? Do they indicate that you may have an effect on reproduction, survival, and growth of the colony? That is what EPA looks at there. And, you know, when you're testing things, have they looked at the control of factors not related to treatment? This is not easy for bees, but it's certainly the area that we're in now, looking at better field studies and better risk assessment. And I think that's what we will see come out in the next few years. And again, I think we all know that laboratory and field data doesn't always relate to the field situation. Many times we've seen compounds that have looked great in the lab as a product, something that will really control disease or insects out there, and they just don't work in the environment because we have a different environment there. So we have to know how to relate our lab studies to our field studies, and sometimes that is not done as well as it could be done. Bee health, we need integrated varroa management, integrated bee management. We do need to find improved bee habitat. We have to have supportive agricultural policies that will help that, targeted research that will inform that debate and the debate around pesticides, and we need collaboration and partnerships. And the crop protection industry as a whole really wants to resolve this issue. We probably use tens of millions of dollars in bees in hybrid seed production and in testing out there. So several companies have started to work in this area. Just very quickly say that we have been in looking at varroacides for maybe 25 plus years. We have been in bee health research. We have been have training ambassador programs where we have 200 plus of our field people trained around the bee so they can go out and talk to people about the risks and the stewardship needed there. And we are opening a Bear Bee Care Center in 2014 to try and bring our knowledge together and make the dissemination of it better. At the same time, Monsanto is working with Biologics on an RNAi solution for varroa control. Syngenta's out there with Operation Pollinator. So I think several of the companies are stepping in to the bee health area as well, as we know it is not a simple issue. And I will leave Jane to talk about the stewardship issue around the ASTA brochure. So just to summarize, fact or fiction, I think the Albert Einstein alarmist rhetoric, let's stick to the facts and talk honestly about these issues. Honeybees are not on the verge of extinction. They might be on the verge of extinction, but they're not on the verge of extinction at the present time. We are able to make more, or the beekeepers are able to make more. We do see rising prices, and it is important to the health of our crops. We need a good supply of bees, and this is an issue that we need to work on. Seed treatment and neonicotinoids are responsible for bee losses. On the overall bee health area, we have no evidence at the present time that says this is a neonicotinoid seed treatment issue. We get a lot of benefit from seed treatments. What we do see are incidents of dust, and we need to work on that, and we need to work as a group to make sure that we resolve that. Is declining bee health a mystery? I think we know an awful lot there. I think there are things we can do. I think the fact that USDA is bringing the expertise together on varroa is great. I think looking at ways that we can improve forage would be greater as well, and I think these things would go a long way to resolving this issue. And I'll leave it at that. Thanks very much.